Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Bob Crawford. Welcome to RTN Theology number 4. Our guest today is Cutter Calloway. He's an assistant professor of theology and culture at Fuller Theological Seminary. He's the author of, well, now 3 books, Watching TV Religiously, Television and Theology and Dialogue, Scoring Transcendence, Contemporary Film Music as Religious Experience, and his current book, Breaking the Marriage Idol, Reconstructing Our Cultural and Spiritual Norms. That's through InterVarsity Press. Just came out a few weeks ago. For me, he was one of my professors. I took a few of his Theology in the Arts classes, and it was Theology in the Arts, and then I took Theology in Television. And he is a wonderful professor whose teaching style is very innovative. His class was the only online class I've ever taken where we actually met together. We were broken into groups, and we would have Skype meetings. We worked on group projects through the internet, which I've taken many online classes, and that's the only time that we ever had that interaction. And in fact, we would meet with him periodically through Skype, and really adds a personal touch to learning, especially if you're learning online, which more of us are these days. Real excited for this interview. Real excited to be back at it. Took some time off, and Ben and I will be back in a few weeks with a new Road to Now. But in the meantime, please enjoy my conversation with Cutter Calloway. Cutter Calloway, welcome to RTN Theology.
Thanks for having me.
Cutter, I've had the privilege of taking a few of your classes through Fuller Theological Seminary. They've had a tremendous impact on the way I watch television and actually how I listen to music. One of the courses I took was Television and Theology. We went through the course. It was wonderful. It really opened my mind about the art of storytelling and kind of the storytelling age we live in today, and how television, even going back to its genesis, the 40s and 50s, kind of was a reflection of society.
Yeah.
So recently, when Roseanne came back, and there was a big to-do about it, right? The ratings for the premiere were through the roof. There was this political connection to it all with the president and Roseanne kind of declaring, I speak for your people, for the press, you know, for the supporters of the president, who often in a popular culture, they do get short shrift probably in many, many ways. And then I watched the show, my wife and I, we would watch it, and it was more complex than that. Uh-huh. I don't know if you had a chance to watch any of the episodes.
No, you know, I hadn't, and I need to go back and find if they're still available or up to view, because everything I heard was exactly what you described, that it, you know, sort of pitched as voicing a space or being a voice in a space for where these voices aren't often heard. But then it was kind of going back to what Roseanne was initially about, and that is this sort of the complex family life, right, that we all sort of navigate and deal with. And that means you do have, you know, an uncle or whoever that thinks differently than you. And you've got your parents and the kids thinking different. You know, all of this sort of lands at the dinner table and on the couch in front of the TV and all that stuff that really does sort of capture, I would like to think, the best of what sort of American society is. Sadly, of course, and the irony of the history now of where Roseanne has gone as a show is that it seems like we as more as a society can't do that, that sort of opposing views and differing perspectives literally can't inhabit the same space. And so for both good and for ill, it seems like it's now kind of an embodiment of where we're at, and where we've come in terms of just culture and in television as well.
It is, but I want to share with you some aspects of the show that made it complicated. Right, there was a gender neutral grandchild. Mm-hmm. There was a young boy who wanted to dress like a girl, and that child was accepted by Roseanne and her husband, and then their son was in a mixed relationship, and he had his wife was African American, and she was serving in the military in Afghanistan or somewhere like that. And then he had their child who was African American. So there was this uproar. But it was more complicated than all that. And like you said, it's a shame that what Roseanne tweeted and how she behaved, and I guess it wasn't the first time she had acted like that, that was taken away from us culturally, because there was a conversation that was going on regardless of what your political persuasion is.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you about television and film, but I feel like it would be wrong of me to not begin this interview by talking about your new book, because when I looked you up to see what you had been up to, I see that you have a new book out, and I'm like, oh, this makes sense. Cutter's got another book coming out. But then I saw it was about marriage. I'm like, what? No, this is the art and theology guy. So there's a book about marriage. And then I got the book this week, and I opened it up, and I say, oh, wait a minute. This is about the stories we tell ourselves culturally.
Well, it is. You're right that it's sort of like, wait, what? If you look at my past work, and even to be honest, the way that it emerged was kind of like that. It wasn't, you know, some sort of strategic intention, like I'm going to write a book about marriage, you know. And part of what it is then me framing it in terms of how I understand these sort of things, these cultural phenomena and whatnot. But it's called Breaking the Marriage Idol, and basically the premise is me saying, in my mind, as I read sort of the culture or subculture of evangelical Christianity, especially over the last, you know, 30-ish years, it seems to me through various publications, through various pieces of art, through various conferences, all the things that go into the kind of making of a subculture, we started narrating, essentially, telling a story about ourselves to ourselves in terms of marriage and singleness and sexuality that, as I looked at it, was not really faithful to what I would see as the history of the Christian tradition, but also not acknowledging both, it kind of back to the Roseanne thing, the complexity of marriage itself and the sort of marginalization that happens of single Christians. Who are in our churches, and in fact are a growing majority in our churches. And so it really emerged from a number of just personal conversations, whether here at Fuller or in my church or in, you know, our network of friends, where people kind of just shared these anecdotes. And this common thread kept coming up that I said, you know what? It seems like what you're encountering is you're running into this story, right? This narrative, this ideal, this norm, really, about marriage that is unhealthy, and we need to maybe do something about it, because all of us, whether single, married, gay, straight, widowed, divorced, we're all dealing with the repercussions of this. So what might it look like to talk about it? What might it look like to lay that on the table, and then maybe to rethink some of the theology behind it and some of our communal practices? So that's really what it's about. And then I go about talking about it in the way that you might expect a person that does stuff in pop culture. So, I say our greatest sort of sex therapists and marriage counselors are things like Disney princess films, The Bachelor and Bachelorette TV show, and Taylor Swift music.
Right, and I have two young children myself, and so I can riff on Moana or Coco, or not so much Coco, but Frozen. So why don't we stop there for a minute and talk about that? Talk about the there's Disney princesses, And then there's the Bachelor television show. What does that tell us about our culture and the way we look at each other as men and women sexually?
Well, you know, it's some people that have read the book earlier or you know got copies. It just came out a couple of days ago, so I'm still getting feedback. But the joke was like, wow, I've never met anyone that had such a like comprehensive, detailed knowledge of Disney princess movies. You know, they kind of are shocked by that. I'm like, well, the reason is because one, I mean, I personally have been shaped by them. I mean, almost every generation since, you know, Walt Disney first made his, you know, first animated film, have really been shaped in profound ways in the ways we understand the world and the stories that we inhabit. And they've changed over time, obviously. But as I was thinking about what are those sort of predominant stories out in the culture, especially in a post-Christian world. So as a Christian, I tend to think and desire for my imagination and my community's imagination to be shaped by the biblical story. And there was a time when the broader cultural consciousness was shaped by that pretty discernibly as well. In the most recent past, maybe the last 50 to 60 years, there's been a steady decline in that. So that even though our narratives aren't and our imaginations aren't shaped by the biblical narrative, other narratives have kind of cropped up to take its place. And so we have these common texts, these common stories, and I think Disney is one of the major players in that. Of you know, you have things, and you could lump in like Pixar. So I just went and saw Incredibles 2. And, you know, it's breaking box office records, in part because children and adults can both access and interact with them. They're compelling at multiple different levels. And so these become sort of the shared narratives of our society. I want to say within the first year, it's not going to be exact right, that Finding Nemo, the initial one, came out, something like 60% of the U.S. population had seen it. Not just children, adults, but 60% of the entire U.S. population, which, like, what other thing could you say that many people had engaged? And so part of what I do in this book is to say these are really profoundly and powerfully shaping narratives. What does it say to us about our understanding of singleness, of married life, of sexuality? And it goes from sort of like a stereotypical early Disney princess films where, you know, you have Prince Charming coming to the rescue, being the hero, saving the damsel in distress, usually literally waking them up from unconscious states through some sort of kiss, some sort of like physical arousal, and then they are immediately swept off into, if not explicitly marriage, sort of happily ever after. And we don't get any of that part of the story. The whole of the story is simply this expectancy that your time has come when you found your prince, your better half, and they are responsible for making you kind of a full-fledged human being. And then over time, you know, that has slightly developed. Disney itself has kind of played with the genre a little bit and challenged it. But what I find really interesting is even in the most sort of progressive movements they've made, the narratives are still really controlled by the guiding sort of myth of romantic love, of marriage, of people being kind of having a soulmate without which they're incomplete. And the pursuit of that soulmate is the primary driver of both their sort of sexual desire, but then their just desire for intimacy, for community, for belonging, etc. And in that sense, it's, I think, a pretty destructive vision of who we are as human beings and how we should relate to one another.
So when you look at this is not an interview about Disney princesses, right? But when you look at Frozen and Moana as two examples, are we seeing a change?
Yeah, I think we definitely are. And I know some people that work at Disney and work on Frozen. So I think Frozen 2, there will be even more, but I'm not at liberty to share what that would be. but yeah, I think there's a self-conscious move, and this is good. I mean, this is where, you know, Moana is great. My girls, I have all three daughters, watch Moana and they love it. I actually don't know if Moana is technically part of the, princess, sort of paradigm, which is interesting. The previews I saw for Wreck-It Ralph 2, came out, and the little girl character in there, and I can't remember her name, they go on the internet and she lands in the princess sort of pantheon, and the princesses don't know who she is. And they're like, who are you? And, you know, and she's like, and they're trying to like question, do you belong here? And she basically said, you know, she needs a big, strong man to come help her. And they're like, oh, you are a princess, right? and so the interesting thing about like Moana or other Disney films is that even when the films themselves are perhaps presenting some helpful narratives, some ways that don't sort of stereotypically treat women specifically or single people in that way, they then quickly get caught up in this larger kind of marketing narrative by the Disney franchise. So a story I share in the book is about Merida from Brave. She was put into the Pantheon of Princesses, and her character was a very non-princessy type, like it, very specifically. And when the artwork was done for putting her in as a part of the princesses, they, you know, enhanced her features in ways that made her more sexualized, tamped down some of the sort of wild red hair, muted the color of it, did all these sort of things, and people revolted for that. But there's not just in the films the narratives, there's this broader narrative work by these kind of big, you know, conglomerates that is the Disney marketing wing of Disney that are also in effect. So Frozen, though, I think is interesting because it both does and doesn't work. So on the one hand, you know, the first film, you have the one sister who the whole thing is she too quickly falls in love, right? And it's kind of a joke. Like, how could you do that? That doesn't work. But still, by the end of the film, she, and my daughters are going to just hate me for getting this wrong, it's Anna or Elsa. I always mix them up. Anna is the one, I believe, who is not does not have the ice powers. But she finally realizes the bad guy is the person she quickly committed to marry. But it's only like a 2.5-day story, if even that. And by the end of the film, she is once again back in a romantic relationship with the guy that she does meet along the way. And so, you know, it, like, even though they're saying they're challenging it on the surface, and the other side, it's like, well, but what do we still get? You know, what comes of this? And then her sister, who is this supposedly, you know, this ice queen, literally, ends the film still kind of isolated and alone in that sense. She's together now with her sister, but it doesn't really address those sort of deeper longings that any of us have for community or offer kind of a vision of what that might be. Now, again, I think Frozen 2 that things change, so I won't say anything, but that's kind of where I stand. But some of my friends at Disney, they disagree with me. So I should say that too.
So then what does The Bachelor tell us about single culture or just our culture in general?
Well, a lot of things. I'm fascinated that The Bachelor and Bachelorette are two of the longest running TV programs in TV history now. They are definitely the longest running reality TV shows, and they continue to gain viewers. That's what's amazing. You know, shows like Survivor or The Voice, or, you know, they kind of have or American Idol or any of these, they have kind of a trajectory that kind of wraps up after a while. They gain an audience and then they kind of die down. But for whatever reason, this show is gaining steam over time. It's not diminishing, and they keep expanding it. So there's something, it tells us something about what captivates the American cultural imagination. So there's something there that people find compelling or interesting. Now, it could be compelling or interesting like a train wreck or or a zoo. You know, those are two very different ways of being interested in something. But I think on the whole, it's a couple things. One is, it demonstrates this notion of infinite choice, that when it comes to romantic relationships or even just how we relate to other humans, that we are basically presented with an unlimited number of choices. And the challenge in that is, one, it's kind of overwhelming and paralyzes you. But two, the very moment you do make a choice, you're immediately unsatisfied because you wonder if you made the right one. And this just lends itself toward a sort of serialized monogamy again, is not rooted in how I understand a sort of biblical notion of intimate relationship. And it certainly on the whole, I would think an unhealthy way of thinking about romantic love just in general. But once again, it's guided by this vision of, and you see it time and time and time again, every bachelor or bachelorette that comes on, they will say, I am in this to find true love, right? Whatever that means. And I want to find my husband or my wife in this process. And the show ends quite dramatically, either with a proposal or not. So we are captivated as a society with this notion that not just romantic love, but romantic love ending in the ultimacy of marriage is something that will ultimately fulfill us, right? That will meet and satisfy the desires of our hearts. And I think that's part of why it's such a compelling show for people. And also, you have people throwing vases and being scandalous, so that helps.
You know, and you're a married man, right? You've been married for how long?
We are, I think, next week. What is it? In a little over a week, we celebrate 18 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
My wife and I celebrate 12 years on July 4th.
Oh, nice.
So, but then you understand from firsthand experience that there's the courting phase of a relationship, and then there's marriage, and then it's a whole new ball game, right? I mean, marriage is fulfilling in ways that go counter to the whole chase, right? The whole chase aspect of a relationship, and then there's, you know, the chase ends, and then it's the happily ever after, right? And that happily ever after is a lot of work, but that's where the growth happens, and that's where the real meaning and the fulfillment is in that work.
When it comes to, you know, because my book is specifically about, some people ask, like mine's specifically about the Christian community, right, and how we talk about marriage, and how we encourage people to get married or not or pursue it. And I think it's right along the lines of what you're saying. So much of what, you know, both as when I was a pastor, a youth pastor, and young adults, et cetera, so much of how we talk about marriage idealizes it and romanticizes it in ways that are really not helpful and just unrealistic. And so what we do is we talk about it, whether it's in that sort of, yeah, that courtship kind of notion, whether it's in a bachelorette kind of way where it's like, oh, you know, this is going to fulfill you in certain ways. And it's not to say that it's not deeply fulfilling in some ways. It's just that it's not the answer to, for example, your sexual desire, right, or sexual angst. It's not the answer to being lonely. It's not the answer to a desire to have kids. You know, these sort of things that often we say marriage is basically going to solve for you. And in my experience, it's the exact opposite. Any of those sort of core difficulties that you as an individual struggle with, whatever they are. Marriage doesn't solve. It actually presents a challenge to those in some really hard ways. And unless you're willing to and committed to the relationship and to the person as a means for growing past and beyond those things, marriage just doesn't work because it like you said, there's the after the honeymoon phase, and it's just a different reality. And so part of my hope for the book and for this is to say, let's be strong advocates for marriage, yes. But at the same time, let's be realists about what we're actually advocating for. So what is it that a Christian marriage is, and why is it that we would want a Christian to be married? Conversely, why is it that we want to hold up singleness as another viable option and a viable vocation that we as a community want to surround single people and support and encourage their vocation in equal measure to the way that we support married people in married life.
So in your research, what are the positive aspects that you found through the Bible about singleness?
Well, you know, I put it at some point in the book that, you know, if we're going to say there is a sort of default status that, you know, I'm hesitant to ever to call some view or something, you know, quote unquote biblical in the sort of adjective sense, because the Bible has a number of perspectives on most things. And there's so many stories and narratives that it's our job as the interpreters to with discernment and wisdom figure out, okay, well, how is this speaking to my context right now? And so it says a lot of things about singleness and marriage, but I think if there's a through line, and especially the places where it's explicit, it's that the default is actually singleness. And the way I get to that is, one, you have sort of Paul's admonitions to his followers and saying, listen, I advocate for singleness. There are certain conditions where pastorally I'm going to accommodate. And in those accommodating places, I say, yeah, go ahead and get married, right? So marriage at best in Paul is an accommodation. Then you get to Jesus, and Jesus himself speaks of, you know, the kingdom to come as one in which we won't be married. We're not married or given in marriage. And you know, there's numerous interpretations of that. But if you're going to take it seriously, we have to acknowledge that there's some sense in which the unfolding of God's kingdom in the world is one where we're not, at the very least, we're not related to each other in the way we imagine it now. And that includes marriage. When you add to that, both Paul and Jesus were single people, and Jesus being the fullest manifestation of God in the world, in my mind, this is more theology speak, but Jesus is actually the most fully human that's ever been. We are all sort of subhuman. It's not that Jesus is a superhuman, but that Jesus is fully human, whereas we are not, right? And in that sense, if Jesus is a full and as fullest expression of a human that could ever have been, that Jesus was single must tell us that there's no such thing as being incomplete, right? That if you're not married, you're not an incomplete human or somehow inadequate or missing a part of yourself or something of how God's designed you. You are a fully formed human being in your own right. And yet, marriage serves a very specific and important function, biblically and elsewhere. And as I look at it, you look at some of the Old Testament passages, the Old Testament marriages, and almost always marriage becomes a kind of mechanism by which God works out other prior callings. So you look at the patriarchs, right? And all of their marriages none of them are about romantic love per se. They're almost always about God is effectively bringing about the people of God in the world through this lineage. And for that to happen, God arranges particular marriages, puts these patriarchs together with spouses so that they can bring about a line of people that will be eventually the nation of Israel. And so even there, where marriage becomes a really important and unique calling on certain people's lives, it really is at the service of a prior and more fundamental calling that has nothing to do with marriage, but isn't marriage per se. And so as I look at biblical texts, those are two things. That one, singleness is sort of the default calling. And two, none of us are generically called to marriage, but instead are called in unique times and situations to marry for the sake of what God is calling us collectively to do.
You know, you have a co-author in this book.
Yes.
Joshua Beckett, Christian ethicist and a same-sex attracted celibate.
Yep.
So talk about that. Like, how did he get involved in the project?
Well, there's a number. So I have actually a number of co-authors in the book.
That is true.
Or less than Joshua. But every chapter is surrounded by a number of vignettes, of stories. And like I said before, the book kind of emerged by me just talking to people in my life that had various stories of encounters with this kind of normative view of marriage, Joshua being one of them. And because every individual was experiencing it in different ways, we were talking about, like, how do we get all of our stories out there? Because, again, as you know, I'm into kind of storytelling in various forms. And one of the hard parts of this book is we're naming something that isn't always made explicit. So the idea that you're incomplete without marriage may not be something that, you know, if you went and polled everybody in your local church, they may not say, oh yeah, that's true. But all of the things we do and the things we don't say communicate very loudly to some people that that's in fact the case. And that's just with singleness and marriage. Now when you start talking about attraction, same-sex attraction, LGBTQ Christians, it's a whole nother level of kind of encoding and decoding that goes on. And as I wrote the book, you know, it started as basically just a book about this marriage norm. And so, you know, as I'm wont to do, I'm like, here are all the things that we're getting wrong, and here's how we messed it up, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I include myself in that. I just want to say that, as a former pastor and current, you know, involved layperson, I'm guilty as charged in the way that I've talked about marriage in the past. But in all of that, the publisher said, you've done a good job of telling us why, we wouldn't want to get married. Maybe you want to write a chapter on why you would get married, because, you know, you're a married guy and, you know, surely, you know, you think that it's good. And I'm like, oh, that's a really good point. And so I thought, okay, if we have a chapter both on why a Christian would get married, I could write that. But I didn't feel, like it would be genuine, or it would be just disingenuous for me to then write the chapter on why single people should stay single, right? That immediately I'm disqualified really from making that claim. It doesn't mean that I would be wrong, in that, but it does mean that I think there's a lack of credibility there for someone who's been with his current spouse for 20 years now, almost, well, over 20 with the time that we dated. And so I was like, we need someone who is single to do this. Joshua presented himself not only because he's, you know, in our doctoral program at Fuller, and about to be done, but also because he's same-sex attracted and has committed to a lifetime of singleness and celibacy. I thought his perspective was really interesting because, let's imagine you're a single Christian right now who would write this, this book. And actually we have a couple single Christians at the time who wrote vignettes who are now engaged to be married. So I joked that's how you get married, is just come co-write a book with me. But in his perspective, he's committed to a lifetime of this. And that, I think, presents the kind of challenge that is unique, and uniquely difficult, but then also, for me, just instructive as a married person, as a person who interacts in his life with all sorts of single folks. The way that Joshua thinks about his calling, his connection with his community, the steering and navigating of his own sexuality, all of that is deeply informative for a person like myself, and I hope for other married Christians and non-married Christians, because one of the points I make in the book is when it comes to sexuality, marriage doesn't solve anything. It just changes the conversation a bit, so that we as married people and married Christians need to be equally chaste as our non-married counterparts, meaning we too have an obligation to live out our lives sexually in a faithful way. And I think we can learn a lot from a guy like Joshua, who has set up a set of practices in his life, for doing that in the most faithful and with the most integrity as I think you can manage.
There is a Christian organization that I won't mention their name, but they've been around since about 1816. And, their primary objective has always been to just distribute the Bible and to have it reprinted into every language. And just to have the Bible available to every living human being so they can discover for themselves what is contained therein. And then it could change their lives. They recently came out with a pledge for their employees. And it's a wide-ranging pledge, but part of it says that marriage is between a man and a woman. And if their employees do not sign this pledge by a certain date, they'll have to leave, and several have already left. I expect more will as the months, as we get closer to, I think it's January 1st, 2019, when they have to sign that pledge. Same-sex marriage is something that end gays in the church. It's one of these, you know, fault lines in secular culture and in Christian culture. How being a professor at a Christian college, how is that being reconciled? How can that be reconciled?
Well, you know, I don't know is the answer. the probably easy answer in terms of, well, and I guess, are you asking how do you reconcile Christians who have differing perspectives on this?
I guess what I'm asking is how will homosexuals ultimately be accepted into the church? Like what will be the reconciliation? Because I suspect that they will. I suspect that at some point they will be, and it will be
just like the Catholic Irish were accepted into American society, homosexuals will be accepted into the church.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in many cases, actually, they already are. I mean, there's an increasing number of denominations and that both approve of, and whether you're a clergy member or are a member of the church, a layperson can be married and be in a same-sex marriage. So it's already happened and happening. And so in that sense, I think you're right. The challenge for me anyway, and this book isn't about gay marriage.
It is not. This is just me asking you this question.
It's fine. I just, the reason I say that is because, it does pertain in this sense. And that is, I do think, one question that we do need to answer as a church body, and I would include in that, or I guess there's two questions we need to answer as a church body. And as best as I can, a big tent sort of evangelical Christian, right? That the people I'm in conversation with span left and right. I have students in and in relationship with churches and denominations that approve and ordain same-sex clergy and marriage, all the way to the other side of the aisle of people who are openly against that, right? And so one challenge is simply, can we find a way, and this, I actually kind of signal this at the end of the book, can we find a way to stay around the communion table with each other? And that is a very difficult challenge, no matter what, but especially in terms of some of these, hot button issues that, societally have become a part of that identity politics we had talked about, before, where simply having even a nuanced view of something puts you in a camp that needs to be, you know, deemed a heresy or something like that. I'm all for a strong and robust disagreement about things within the Christian community, as long as we can do that with a commitment to say, you're still my sister and brother in Christ, and I'm still committed to you. That is something we need to do no matter what the topic of concern is. But especially when it comes to actual marginalized groups in our midst, there is no such thing as, however we answer this question of staying in communion with each other, there is no such thing as gayness. There are only gay people, right? There's only individuals who are themselves lesbians, gay, transgendered. And as Christians, I think it's our obligation to find ways to navigate that, however that is. So that's sort of one comment of whatever the answer is, which I don't know, I can't see down the future to see how these two camps will reconcile. My hope is that we are committed to each other. The other side of it is, and this is part of the point of the book, that is, I do think we also want to rethink marriage, whether for the straight Christian or the gay Christian. And that is to say that I think it's a setup to our gay brothers and sisters in Christ to have them believe, just like it's a setup to any straight Christian, that marriage is somehow going to solve for them a problem that it was never designed to solve, right? That that issues of sexual desire, that issues of loneliness, that issues of meaning and fulfillment in life are all going to be answered by this one relationship, when in fact, I think the Christian vision is that we find our fulfillment in a community, right? A collective body of Christ that comes around and supports and structures each other. And that includes those who are married. Even that picture of the couple, right? The lone couple that's completely fulfilled, doesn't really need the rest of the people around them, is false. We, as married people, need others. We need other male and female friendships in our lives to live a robust sort of Christian life. And that's the other side where I do think, and I hope, this book, at least, even though it's not about gay marriage, could be helpful as a part of that conversation to say, when it comes to our lesbian and gay brothers and sisters, how are we helping support them as a community as well?
I can't let Cutter Calloway go without asking you a few film and television questions. My wife and I went to go see First Reformed a few weeks ago. And wow. You know, there were times where we looked at each other like, yes, yes, this is so great. This is great. And then we walked out of the theater completely dumbfounded, and our jaws were just hitting the floor. And I said to her, I said, I wonder what Cutter Calloway thinks about this. And I knew that you had just interviewed the director and writer, Paul Schrader. So tell us about that movie briefly, and your interaction with Paul Schrader, and what did you make of it? What were your initial thoughts at the end of that film, without being a spoiler?
Yeah, well, without spoiling it, it's true because it's still in theaters, or just newly in theaters actually at the time of us talking right now. Here's what I can do. I'll say as soon as you see it, or if you're not going to see it and want to know, Fuller Studio has the video of my conversation with Paul Schrader and then Justin Chang, who's the key or the chief film critic at the LA Times. Really fascinating conversation. And, you know, I walked away with just a number of things. I mean, one, it's Schrader trying to make, for the first time in his career, a film that is what he would call a transcendental style film. And he wrote a long time ago, as his master's thesis, actually, a book called Transcendental Style in Filmmaking. And he looked at three or four directors as epitomizing this kind of style that he says evokes a sort of spirituality that sort of mass entertainment does not, in his mind. And it all hinges on like really still, or still as an STILL, like a slow moving or non moving cameras. It kind of almost a boredom that it causes in the viewer. And then at some moment, this moment of stasis that then gets interrupted. And that's the moment where you kind of move to a transcendental, you know, moment. So that's, he had never made that. And he said, in fact, that's not what he was into. He just observed it in some of these other artists. But then finally, now he's 70 something and he's like, I think I want to try to make this film. And this is the one. He grew up, you know, a Dutch Calvinist in a pretty strict Calvinist home, went to Calvin College actually. And so has always, this is my read of it, been sort of haunted by his religious upbringing and his past. And now really fascinatingly with this film, and then just his own biography is at a point where he's kind of returning to religion. And that I think was one of the most sort of profound insights for me, is saying like, oh, this is partly a kind of prayer of his, if you will. The movie, this isn't a spoiler, but starts off with Ethan Hawke's character, who is a pastor, a clergy member, and is, you know, at a small historic, like literally a church that's literally a museum. Mm-hmm. Find a really fascinating picture, because our churches are becoming that in many ways. Conversely, things like museums and storefronts are where churches are cropping up, right? So it's this weird reversal. But it does sort of haunt our imaginations as a society, especially in the United States. We were such a churched and church-based country for so long, and still, you know, in terms of human history, it's still pretty recent past, but very quickly that sort of influence is evaporating, and yet we're left with these sort of images and hints and pictures and buildings that remind us of this. And so in a lot of ways, that's kind of how I see this this film, is him drawing on that early imprint in his life to say, now how do I navigate something like the coming ecological crisis? And again, if you haven't seen the film, again, not to spoil it, that's one of the sort of key points of what drives the narrative forward is it even worth bringing children into the world knowing that humans are destroying the earth, right? And what does a faith, what does specifically a Christian faith have to say about that? How does it help us navigate that, talk about it? And I think some of the most, probably the parts where you and your wife are nodding your head, were some of the moments of dialogue between Ethan Hawke and this environmentalist character that he meets, that I just thought really profound and compelling. But then, yes, mm-hmm. at the end, it is the end, and that's all I'll say. And when I first saw it, it was on a screener before it had released, all this other stuff. And I'm like, I've got to talk to somebody about this. And I couldn't right. find anyone who had seen it to be like, what did I just watch? And what's going on? And why did that happen? And, you know, so in that sense, it's either like, it's one of these films that, you know, it's kind of an art house cinema type thing. And either it's just a stroke of utter brilliance or it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it's fun to say it's up for a matter of interpretation. And Schrader himself would say, it invites multiple reads. And many of them are equally legitimate. So
part of the Road to Now, mission statement is how did you get here, right? Cutter Callaway, how did you get to be Dr. Cutter Callaway at Fuller Theological Seminary studying art and theology?
Ooh, well, that's a good question. And the short answer is through no strategy or an intentionality. I was and still feel called to the local church, and was raised Baptist. I'm ordained Baptist, actually. And so early on was in ministry in a handful of different settings. And I just kept encountering, part of it was the churches that I was a part of. One I helped plant when I was in college, and we played a lot of rock and roll. As I say to people, we really hated the institutional church, but we loved Jesus, rock and roll, and coffee. So just imagine the church that comes out of that, and that was our church.
Sign me up.
Yeah. And many people did. And so it grew and we moved pretty quickly. You know, I was playing, you know, Pearl Jam and Metallica in as a part of like our church services, as like a touchstone for conversation and biblical interpretation. And then we moved pretty quickly in the life of our church into an old sixplex movie theater that had gone out of business. Right. So immediately. And we didn't have money to renovate or anything, so we just met in the actual theaters with the theater chairs and the big screen. And so, given that context, we couldn't help but interact with and engage, not just culture, but specifically audiovisual storytelling, right, of our culture. And so, it was trial and error and what does it mean to incorporate movies either into worship or to engage them as a part of the conversation? But that was a part of what I did and how I kind of learned and grew as a pastor. And then as I continued in that role, and in other places outside of that church too, I just realized that most of the pressing questions that both individual Christians were facing, but then as a community as a whole, really had to do with what do we make of the culture in which we live? What do we make of the TV we watch and the movies we see and the music we listen to? When I go see that, you know, if you're in a place where you do have a museum installation, what do I do when I have a completely sort of atheist artist presenting me with something that, man, it sure seems like I met God there, right? I mean, all of these questions that came up. And so I just stupidly thought, I'll just keep learning. I'll keep going to school for this thing. And so I did, and I eventually got a PhD in it. And after that thought, well, do I go back into church ministry? Because I take a break to actually, you know, do the schooling. And I was never quite sure because I felt like being a faculty member would be sort of a one degree of separation from church life. Being at Fuller, being that it's an evangelical seminary, I got a lot of really great models in terms of the faculty here that, yes, they're academics and yes, they do scholarship, but they're also all very passionately and deeply involved in their churches. And so, I thought if that's a possibility there at that place, then that's kind of where I want to be and where I want to teach. And so that's kind of where I'm at now. I'm now a faculty member teaching and writing and researching this stuff, but then, that frees me up to also be an overeager volunteer at my local church, which has been kind of a great new season in life because I kind of see my role now, as a layperson, finding any way that I can to, share the burden of pastoral ministry that I know is really grinding. So if I can preach on a weekend, if I can lead some music, if I can do any of these number of things that just ease the burden that is pastoral ministry, it really is, I've really enjoyed that these last few years, being able to be a part of the church in that way. So that's my road to now.
And for our listeners out there, this exists.
right? Theology and the arts. I was with my good friend Chris Breslin, who I've done a show with him before, but he's a pastor in at Oak Church in Durham, North Carolina. And I was taking classes at another institution, and he said, I said, you know, I just don't know. He said, why aren't you at Fuller? Why aren't you studying theology and the arts? This is what you do. And it was just so exciting to take your classes. And I highly recommend watching TV religiously. Cutter's book, Watching TV Religiously. You'll never watch TV the same again. And
in a good way.
And in a very good way. And we got to watch part of the class. We watched the whole Luke Cage season one, and I got my wife on it, and we're so excited. Season two just came out. So, but it's waiting for us at home. And so Cutter Calloway, thank you for being here. The book is Breaking the Marriage Idol, Reconstructing Our Cultural and Spiritual Norms. That's published by InterVarsity Press. Go out and get it. And look up Cutter Calloway. And again, Cutter, thank you so much for being a guest.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Osiris.
This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.